All right, we're back. This is side two, take five. I'm sorry, you were talking about your teaching method, and you were talking about relevance, how important that was, that the student could see the connection. Did you want to add anything to that?
There's one more factor to it, is that I emphasize this teaching is aimed at the graduate class. Mm-hmm. And what that translation is, students are now shifting from the textbook reading, learning, into reading the original research articles.
Right.
And that's a big transition, because up to that point, starting probably from elementary school, and what we're learning is what is said in the textbook.
Mm-hmm.
So I emphasize repeatedly to them that those days are over. So then no one can write textbook for you anymore.
Right.
On what you're learning, because we have not even understand it yet. We have not written textbook on this yet. The textbook is typically 5-7 years behind the discovery.
Right.
And but you're a graduate student now, you're in the forefront. And then I have to teach the method how to read the research articles. What really saying behind those kind of teaching is that now you are entering a period learning something that is really ongoing, that you have to use your own judgment, you have to be critical. Because we all have this tendency when we read a textbook, we trust everything was said in the textbook,
exactly.
Otherwise it won't be textbook.
Mm-hmm.
But the research article is a different story, because that's ongoing research. And there is could be incomplete, could be misinterpreted, could be missing appropriate controls. And it's not textbook anymore, it's not Bible anymore,
mm-hmm.
and it may not be right anymore. And so you have to develop your ability to read it, to judge it, to critical it, to criticize it. Otherwise, you will not be able to develop into independent scientist.
Right.
So that one thing I emphasize a lot, because I realize this is a different class. Yeah, and so I emphasize a lot on that one, as well as the big pictures. Because then everything I said in the first lecture I teach each year is tell them then whenever you start reading something, doing something, always asking what I am doing. Why am I doing this?
Right.
And very soon, within a few hours, once you get into the lab, you just dig your head into the sand and the specific and the project, and very easily forgot the picture and all of what you're doing in the big field. So that eventually can drive you feel dry and you don't feel excited and you just forgot what you're doing is why is this so important? People always forgot asking those questions. They forgot
right.
to make big connections, because the science is not developed. Whole field is not built by one individual, one experiment. Instead, it's composed of multiple small projects and developed simultaneously. But you ought to be able to understand what you're doing and how it's contributing to the whole field of development.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't ask that question a lot. And
right.
So without thinking about that one, you eventually get lost. Yeah.
Right. No, and what you say about critical thought, I think, is very important, because I know from teaching history at the community college level, I attempt to do the same thing. You know, I try to get the students to think, you know, why should we believe this? Why are we learning this? What's the big picture? And there's an immense resistance to that, though.
Oh, yeah. It's automatic resistance.
It really
it's
is.
Automatic. And yeah. Otherwise, you just listen to it and they just memorize it and trust it.
Right.
And but try to be critical is very difficult, and especially for the first and the second year grad student. And they make a transition, they said, yeah, so if I make a critical point and they try to say this is not right, then a few minutes later and people say, yeah, this is already documented and this is right.
Mm-hmm.
And I can hardly make a discovery, something that based on my reading that I'm right and the author was not right.
Right.
I say, yeah, but if you don't do it, you don't get that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, how would you describe your lab management style?
That's the one thing I've been learning from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, I feel that I'm more organized than most other people I know of. And that was also reflected from the fact that when new people come to the lab, the first impression is the lab is very organized. And that's for the efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we generate a lot of reagents. And we develop a lot of lines of very important history. But if not organized well, and people will waste a lot of time to repeat the same thing that already been done before. And the only way to avoid that is by organizing the lab very efficiently so people can get to the last development someone else made it before and go on from that point, instead of go back and repeat to make the same construct again, to generate the same antibody again, to make the same, to do the same experiment again. That's kind of waste. So I emphasize lab need to be and organized very efficiently. And that's why I spend an awful lot of time myself still now and in organizing the lab, to even keep up the lab stock for plasmid, for antibody. Because I'm the only one staying in the lab and the entire period of 7 years, the people coming and the goes. And then so I figured that no one else can keep up that kind of job. And then I'm the only one can do it. So actually I'm doing this myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that actually helps a lot for the people in the lab. And the new people coming to the lab, as soon as introduced into the system, they can dig out the things by themselves. But if not organized well like that, that would not be possible.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Earlier you talked about how Ike Bush was someone that you had a very close relationship to. You could go to him. That's probably because it was a small lab. And then later when you went to the Beach Lab, it was more difficult, probably again because of size, but I'm sure other factors as well. Where do you see yourself in that sort of continuum?
And I really want to combine. Combine both is not the right way to say it, because you can't combine those two different pictures.
Yeah.
And I'm more towards like in the Ike Bush method.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want, and I've been trying, and I think I have a close relationship with everybody in the lab. And to say that I view the lab as sort of like a family is probably not really overstated, because I do see that the people spend 5 years or 4 years each other in a such close environment, and it's very important period of time. And not only important for these 4 or 5 years and in the lab, but also for the future. So I myself and setting up example to have a close relationship with people in the lab, and by have a constant conversation with them, very informal ones,
right,
on a daily basis, ever possible. And also encouraging people in the lab to develop a good relationship among themselves. And somehow just setting up the collaboration among the peoples, by forcing them to communicate each other, and by having joined the lab meeting and they join the club, every mechanism I can imagine to it. Because I think and by the time they finish, they will live in here, and that they will develop a collaboration, working relationship among themselves much easier than they would with people outside the lab, because they know each other so well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that one's, and so far so good. We're doing pretty well on that part. And a lot of people after leaving the lab, they become close friends among themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We should put on the record too that yesterday we had sort of an informal birthday party, right, for two or three people in the lab. So we had great cake, by the way. Anyway, describe the makeup of your lab.
The lab is made up typically half postdoc and a grad student, plus one or two supporting technicians right now. And the number of personnel in the lab are fractured between, at a high point, it was like we got 18 people in the lab, and to right now, and about 10 or 12 people. And so people coming and the goes. But it's typically half. In post, senior postdocs and a grad student in the lab. And I always have like a one or two technicians supporting the lab and responsible for like medium preparations and dishwashers, orderings, and some kind of routine plasmid preparations like that. But it's very technical supporting.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you see the lab growing? Would you want it to grow?
I would like the lab to grow, and I think and I'm capable of managing a big lab, and so I'm not afraid to have a big lab, and I still can run efficiently. And more importantly, that we have to have a critical mass, and that people in the lab are really interacting with each other more efficiently than they would with people outside the lab. So if you have like a small lab, just 4 or 5 people, and they don't have much communication, they feel a little isolated, less excited. And that also they lost the potential to take advantage of and publish new discoveries. But if you made a discovery in the lab, and often it will lead to further questions and further research. So that give you an advantage, and before anybody else even knows it. Yeah. And so that's why, and I think and the maintaining a critical mass above people of 10 or 12 is necessary.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. And the next couple questions are about administrative responsibilities and also your professional duties. First, what are some of your administrative responsibilities?
Almost none.
Really?
Almost none. And I purposely avoided. And the B, I don't know if it's good or not.
Right.
I'm a little too straightforward. And so to run an administrative job, like running a department or some kind of program or center, mm-hmm. and if it's not purely scientific, I don't know if it's good or not. I don't know. I never tested myself. And I'll be good on that or not. And I might be too blunt. People may not like it.
Mm-hmm.
And but on the other hand, I could be very efficient and just running my lab. And that being very efficient, so I don't know. But the main reason is that I've been trying to purposely avoid this, yeah, so for administrative jobs. But professional jobs and being involved and preactively and attending meeting, traveling around to give lectures, and serving as a consultant for different companies, and serving reviewer for both NIH grant review as well as a number of different journals.
Right.
So that is being constant, and that's very professional. So I don't think that actually only enhanced my own research to a certain extent, even though it takes some time away from me.
Right.
Yeah.
How much time, I mean, roughly, percentage-wise?
Not too much right now, and because I'm getting more and more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask me a rough estimate, I would not put more than 10% of my time. At the most, no more than 15%. It's fluctuating. And sometimes it got like flux of the number of manuscripts coming in the same week. And but sometimes I'll be getting quiet. And sometimes I'll travel quite a bit. And like whole 2 weeks I'll be outside the lab and traveling around. And but in general, and I probably spend more time in the lab than most of my colleagues.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, very important to your profession, too, is getting papers out, getting them published. Could you describe the journal writing process that you've developed?
That's the one thing I don't think I did a pretty well job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing pretty fast. I'm very good. I'm a fast writer.
Right.
And even though it's writing English, I'm still pretty fast. And reasonably good, but not as good as I would like to, because I'm a very good Chinese writer. I have very solid training in Chinese writing,
mm-hmm.
and not just using the word and the terms, but also the structure-wise and the flow. So that's probably more important than anything else, is clarity. And although the scientific writing is less demanding than or less fancy than the literature or writing, but still it requires clarity. So that's one thing, and for the young student and the senior, the postdoc, they're not doing pretty well. And I'm not patient enough. So very often, once we get the result, and I just cook the paper pretty quickly myself in a couple of days. So to me, it's pretty quick, and just not patient enough, and it's not very good for them. But looking back, and I didn't get a whole lot of training by those papers when I was a graduate student or postdoc either.
Right.
And the paper published during the postdoc was the most written by my mentor. And I wrote the first draft, but not very good ones. So he just turned around. And then when I started myself, I can still do it. So I don't think that is so terribly important.
Mm-hmm.
And practically, and what's important is get the paper out. And once they get the paper, they can move on with their career, to get a job, and they can get this training later. It's important, of course, but I don't think it's as crucial as published papers for them.
Right.
Yeah. Instead, let them spend like a month to write the paper, and then I just figured that just I spend 2 days and to finish a paper, we send out and then move on. They're much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's also dependent. So some people they have come in with very good writing skill and they let them do it. And I got a few people that have very good writing, and so in that case I let them to write.
Right.
But in the majority case I wrote the most part, if not the whole paper myself.
Mm-hmm. Now those who write their own papers, do you go over it several times or how do you work that?
A couple of times, not
right.
very over. And I enjoy a lot with good writers.
Right.
I have to say myself, and is above average writers. So I can tell the good writing from the lousy writings.
Mm-hmm.
So if people in the lab and have good writing skills, and I actually enjoy writing with them, then we can really start digging in the styles and how to make things clear. Because sometimes if you're writing things clearly, not only just a stylist, but also tells you tells readers how clear you are conceptually about what you're doing scientifically.
Right.
So that's important. And I've been, and I had several people in the lab, and they're all Americans, and they have very solid training from the high school and the college years, and they write very well, very clear. So they helped me a lot, actually.
Right.
And so that's the one thing I learned from them more than from anyone else. Yeah.
Okay.
But unfortunately, and the more than half the people in the lab are not English as a mother language, and a lot of American students and the postdocs, they are not even writing as good as I am. So that's a shame for them. And they must not study hard enough when they were in high school or college for the English training.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Now, I know from interviewing someone at Caltech, they, I think, had instituted a program where they actually had a class that biomedical students could go attend and learn how to write a paper. It seems maybe, too, that they could maybe devise a program where you could learn how to run a lab. That also seems like a valuable skill that you don't usually get.
Yeah, so our department has a course for that, and they're called a grant writing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I have not seen directly what kind of impact have on students, but I was not involved in the teaching, and without being able to compare in how bad they were before they started, and how much they improved at the end of class, so I can tell what kind of benefit they have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I myself was not emphasized that very enough myself. So if they're good, and I'm working with them. If they're not good, I say, well, just give it to me, I write it. Yeah.
Right. Right. How often do you attend scientific meetings or symposia?
I think, generally speaking, often enough, two or three times a year.
Oh, yeah.
And it depends. And most of the time, nowadays, I don't really go to a meeting unless I was invited. And so that actually limited somewhat. And I don't like just take the money out for the research grant to go to a meeting myself if
right.
I was not invited. Instead, I sending people in the lab to go. And but still, and I'm going at least like once a year at least in the national or international meeting myself. Not including the small and the local meetings. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're also on, have you been on study sections? And
yeah, I've been on study sections, and so far I was able to convince the people not serving on the regular members, which is very heavy duty.
Isn't
it? It's very heavy duty, and you're talking about, and if you go every time, like 3 times a year, 2 weeks each time, 4 times, you have to read a lot.
That is.
And so this is the one grant I'm reading. This much, that's one. This much plus that much, plus the whole deck.
Right.
That's just one.
Right, you're pointing to a couple piles of papers here.
Yeah. And so I'm going next Monday to start a section for this one. It's awful lot of work. And so the first reason I use is I haven't got my tenure yet, and you got to give some leverage or room for the junior faculty. And before asking to serve, they say, okay, we think that's a good reason. We let you off for a few years, and you're going to come back, right? I said, okay, I will come back. And so I've been back and serving energy study section on ad hoc basis, but not regular members. I don't know how long I can keep on doing that.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It's a learning process too, but it's just too much time.
Yeah,
too much time. But on the other hand, it's a duty, and we all have to do it. And at some point, and if everybody finds a reason not to do it, I mean, then who can do it?
Right.
Yeah, this is one of the best system, and in terms of determined funding, is by peer review system, and it's not perfect, but no one else can come with any better system than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Another professional responsibility is grant writing. How describe that process? Does it take a lot of time?
That's lifeline supply for everybody, and that's the one thing I really learned an awful lot. And still evolving process, but I'm getting better and better. And I didn't realize it was difficult. And because when I first got here and submitted my first R1 application, and it's got right away, got a very good, and the review is outstanding. And I wrote a second one, and it was outstanding again. I said, "Whoa, this is easy."
What are people talking about, right?
Yeah, I said, "This is easy." I said, "Why is everyone so difficult?" And
right.
And the people say, "Well, yeah, and I don't know, you're writing good or your field is pretty hard right now or not, but it's not supposed to be that easy for everybody." And then, yes, when I come to and compare the renewal last year, and then I realized it was not so easy, because then once you establish, the people using different criteria judge you, and you're still learning process. And But I have to say that is the single most learning experience I had since I became independent faculty, because that really forced me to stay out of the lab and to read systematically, to give an overview of what we have done in the last 4 years and what the field have moved on in the last 4 years. Therefore, I can propose what we're going to do in the next 5 years.
Right.
Yeah, and otherwise, there's no other mechanism can force me to do that.
So it forces you to see the bigger picture again.
To see the bigger picture and to really sit down to read the thinking about this was.
Right.
Yeah.
Any lessons you could pass on to sort of new PIs about, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot. Yeah, and the first and the foremost is to find a good person to talk to. And a good person means that they have enough experience of serving on the study section, mm-hmm. and being successful in doing the research, and being successful in getting grant. Because not just what you propose is important, but also how you propose is important. And you got to keep in mind that and what you're writing is not a sum of your research. What you're writing is you try to communicate what you accomplished and what you want to do with somebody who is not necessarily in your field. Mm-hmm. If they don't understand, it's not their fault, it's your fault.
Right.
Yeah, we don't understand this very well. We always assume that everybody knows what we're doing. It's not, because the field is moving so fast. We all become a specialist. You ask someone outside your field to judge your stuff, and if you can't communicate very well, and you can't blame them. If they don't understand it well, how can you ask them to just blindly give you money, mm-hmm. right? And then when the money is a little bit loose, it's abundant, it's another issue. If like 30 people get funded, that may not be so terribly important, because as long as you keep on probably doing well, and they can say, okay, this guy has a pretty good tracking record, even though I'm not entirely clear what he or she will be doing next 4 or 5 years, and I trust them. Mm-hmm. But when money is tight, that was not the issue. Right. And then we can say, yeah, not only your tracking record is important, but also, and then how clear you're writing, how important you're going to do next 4 years, is also important, mm-hmm. right? And so really talking to people, don't close door, just write yourself. And ask some people to read it, especially the people not necessarily in your field, to make sure it's clear.
Okay.
Yeah, because at that point, you're not going to change a whole lot about your science. You can't just in that 1 month period of time of writing grant and they just say, okay, I'm going to start a new field, I'm going to develop a whole new approach, whole new technology. That's not going to happen.
Right.
And so that, more or less, you're going to write based on what you've already done. But the important thing is to write clear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does it take about a month then to write a grant too for you? Say a pretty good medium to large size grant.
I set a month for myself, because once getting to the last month, and then I set my mentality into the writing. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I ever spend a whole month for a single grant. I usually have, if really putting together, have 2 weeks.
Right.
But I start a month earlier to finish some paperwork to make sure everything is behind me, except the body part of the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that final 2 weeks, and I can just focus on the proposal without worry about whether I got a figure ready and I got my appendix ready, whether those document forms are ready, anything like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, if I've read your CV correctly, you received tenure in 1999.
I see what?
You received tenure in 1999?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So congratulations, that was fairly soon. Not too
That was pretty normal, slightly a year ahead
in
the schedule. And so we normally at this place, this institution, then they review a tenure around year 7. And which means you got about year 7, between year 7 and year 8. So that was a year ahead. So they call it early promotion. But I have to say, was not too surprised.
Mm-hmm.
It was not too surprised, because this is a public university, and we are not setting up the competing among the colleagues each other. That you are competing with yourself for the tenure slot.
Right.
So the slot is there, and if you're doing well, you can have it.
Right.
And it's not like some places that, and no matter how well you're doing, and if you have like 5 junior faculty up to tenure review this year, won't have 2 or 3 slots. So somebody has to go. Mm-hmm. But that's not our situation here. That's one distinction between the public school from the private school.
Right.
And also from judging and what we've been publishing, and what we've been getting in terms of funding and the award, and what and I've been hearing from my colleagues. So I know that and I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. And actually I'm doing pretty well. So I know that and should not have too much difficulty. Yeah.
And what was the tenure process? Was it long?
It's a long process, and they take home 9 months. And it's start and by chairman to appoint a senior faculty in the department as a chair of tenure review committee, mm-hmm. which composed of the three additional and the full tenured professor, along with the chair. And then they will come sit down with me and say, well, we're going to initiate a tenure process. We want you to summarize what you're doing and in writing. And in your CV, including everything, ranging from your teaching, funding, publication, and invited seminars, national, international review and the duties, so on and so forth, everything. Okay, and we're asking the copy or reprint of every paper you've been publishing. Right. I will get all the material from you, then the department will go to the department has a mechanism to accumulate and the teaching evaluations. So that's one of three components of a tenure review process, being the teaching, research, and administration. The third one doesn't apply to me, so it will be just teaching and research. So whenever the material got together and they think about this is good enough, they're going to start a formal process. And one of the first things they're going to do is sending out 10, I think it was 10 or 12 letters outside the campus and to the leaders in the field and we are working on, and they solicit their opinion on the how we are doing or mm-hmm. how I am doing. And so the whole road of review, we don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know. Okay, you can make some suggestions, but they don't really necessarily follow what you're asking for.
Right.
Okay, but it has to be someone recognized in the field. The UL is a red range of the department chairman or institution leader or director, National Academy of Science, and the senior faculties in the field. So they have a fair comparison of you with similar junior faculty in other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But otherwise, and we know we're not competing with anybody in the department. So the people within the campus can just, oh yeah, you are good, and you are good. Everybody say everybody's good, and mm-hmm. say, that's not critical enough.
Right.
So when all the letters comes back, so that then the committee will get them together to review all those materials to determine what's the deficiency or whether this is good enough to write a recommendation to forward to the medical school. And the medical school have a committee, they will review it. And then the whole medical school will submit to the university. The university will review all together. And then with the applications from and the various department before they submit to the board for approval. But the last stage is pretty much and the rubber stamp. So
right.
if the university recommend the president or chancellor or the board of governor always accept, well, not always, but you will accept.
Pretty rare, yeah.
Pretty rare that they turn down, yeah.
Okay, what does tenure mean here specifically?
Tenure means nobody can kick me out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's doing something crazy, unethical or criminal.
Right.
And it's just give you one indication that you are moving ahead of your career development. You are not junior anymore, so you can't have those perks anymore.
Right.
That's one thing. And also that then it means then to me that I have to take more responsibilities and outside the lab.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just say I'm still at the early stage of my career development. I have to study my lab first. And I have to get more involved in the administration jobs outside the lab. And tenure also means you feel a little bit more confident and mentally or psychologically that and you are more secure in terms of your position.
Right.
And as long as you keep on doing good work and your institution is behind you, because they are your tenured faculty in this institution. And then so you can afford more competitiveness that if the research doesn't produce much in the next couple of years, so it's not as huge a deal as early on. Then you're really focusing on publications, on getting grant, and almost on a yearly basis, and to accumulate enough before year 6 or year 7.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes less demanding or less obvious. So that lets you to afford to think about instead of talking about the quantity of your research, of your publication, and they shift you more and more and focusing on the quality
right.
of your research.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's always been struggling for the junior faculties. not only for their own sake, but also for the sake of people in the lab. And whether and you can be patient enough to do a long-term research, do a high-quality research, which means taking risk and be patient.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, just to finish up this particular section, I just wanted to ask a few questions about your family. We had already gone over that, you know, you had married, for instance, in 1985.
Yeah.
Okay. How did being married affect you, your life, and your work?
Tremendously. Yeah. I was a wild boy before getting married, and I was very outgoing, and I had all kinds of interest. And so one of the first direct impact and the marriage on me is making me able to focus.
Right.
Yeah. And so I don't have to go around to do every crazy things anymore. Or I don't need to, or I don't want to, and I'm not enjoying anymore. So I'm really focusing. So that's the one thing. And so the first 5 years of our marriage was very, very peaceful, very, very simple, because that was just two of us. Yeah. And the only thing we have is just research and research and research in terms of my professional life.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, we had a very happy marriage, and 15 years by now. Yes, we had up and the downs, and the tough time, and the stress time, and the difficult time, but overall, it's a very happy marriage. Yeah, and the tough time was came from doing the postdoc study at the Cold Spring Harbor Lab, and we both were doing the postdoc research full time, and our daughter was very young,
mm-hmm.
and that was tough for both of us.
Yeah,
and,
that must have
been. And partly because I am more of self-centered, and I did not know. It's actually also a learning process, just like and many other things as well. And how do you view your family and versus your own research? I'm not doing very well on that part.
Right.
And so even my daughter knows, and sometimes I work too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're still trying to find that sort of balance between
still,
the professional and duties?
I'm still learning that one. And it's not easy. It's not easy. And it's not linear, so that you have extra hours, and outside, out of home, and in the lab, you get more productive, or vice versa. It's mm-hmm. not always like that. It's more of a quality issue here. So I don't think I'm doing very good on that part. And I'm still learning these ones. And sometimes we have to struggle through together. And so my wife always tell me that, repeatedly, that and sooner or later you're going to feel regret that you're not spending enough time with Jesse,
mm-hmm.
then you're missing a lot of stages. And those early development of childhood, when it's gone, you can never get it back.
Right.
And then you're not going to see that anymore. Mm-hmm. You can see some pictures, but it's different.
Oh, yeah.
And she told me repeatedly that and she had been enjoying a whole lot more than I did. And so you tell me that, and I already missed a lot, and I'm still missing it. And I think I do agree with her on that part. But on the other hand, that the research is demanding,
mm-hmm.
the job is pretty demanding.
Right.
Not to mention that I have a lot of interest into it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know who actually is the better example on those issues. I have not found one yet.
Right.
Yeah.
So it sounds then as if your wife has done most of the child rearing responsibilities?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons early on and then before completion of her postdoc training, and she decided not to pursue independent research position like what I'm doing right now, because that would be too demanding for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And she would not enjoy that too much, and it would definitely not very good for the family. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in running a household, in running your household, how do you break up the responsibilities and duties? How does that fall?
Not a good way.
In what way is it not a good way?
Because my wife is pretty much the one taking care of the family.
Right.
And I'm doing very minimal, I have to say. Not much. Not much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And not a whole lot. Yeah, we're trying to learn this right now.
Yeah, it's
but not much at all.
Okay. Now, your daughter is born in 1990, right?
Yeah.
And what was the impact of her birth on you and your wife, for that matter? How did it change your life?
That had a big impact on both of us, especially on my wife. So that must have really got her into thinking what he want to do in the long run.
Right.
And that also, for the first time, make me feel that there's something more important in my career. And that comes, I think it was second year when we were at the Cold Spring Harbor Lab, when Jesse was a little more than a year old. And mm-hmm. one day we got a phone call from a doctor, and from what was in the lab, asking us to take Jesse go to emergency right away. That morning we had Jesse checked up because she developed this chin and this bruise and on her chin.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what it was, and she didn't feel much pain. We thought she just bumped somewhere. And so doctor took some blood tests and they just sent us home. And then a few hours later, and they gave us a call, said, and they just go to the hospital emergency room. I already made an appointment for you. Without telling us what was going on. That scared the shit of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was running, was speeding up and running through the red light or something, just went to the hospital. We don't know what's happening.
Right.
And we didn't know the answer for several days. And they keep on bringing the more check and more check, and even bring at the end the oncologist. And of course, we know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And when the oncologist is brought up, which means she might have the chance of developing leukemia.
Right.
And they did all this kind of blood test, and they even did the bone marrow testing. And they said, end up with, and she had this autoimmune deficiency disease. And her immune system was eating up her own platelet.
Wow.
And making her unable to stop breathing efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever she bumped something, and she would have this bruise on her chest, on her her skin. So that, if it's very severe, could be pretty dangerous, because and the kids doesn't know this stuff, and they can just bump into a head somewhere, got internal bleeding,
right.
And unable to stop it. So that could be dangerous. That time you realize the Cell paper, Nature paper, grant, that doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was pretty devastating, and for until couple of weeks later, figure out what's going on, and they determined there's no chance this anything got leukemia or lymphoma, anything like that. It's just an autoimmune disease, and it's treatable. And all we need to do is and regularly go back to the hospital and treating her, and administrating by IV injecting of and immunoglobulin
mm-hmm.
to suppress her immune and response. And eventually, she will correct herself. When the develop, it's common actually, pretty common. We didn't know that at the time.
Mm.
And by the time they get into their around the 10 or 12 years old, and they will correct themselves. Only 5% of cases, they will not be able to do it still. And then the doctor will remove a spleen. And even that is not going to have a big impact for the overall health. And they might have a decreased immune defense system, but it's not a huge amount.
Right.
Yeah. And so she's over now, and well, for some time already. And after we left the Long Island, we never need to go back to the hospital again.
Right.
Yeah. So that tells you that you feel that there's something more important than your career. And you know it. You feel pretty happy when you play with her, but you don't, when you feel from a different angle, that you actually could lose your kids, and
it's
completely different feelings.
Yeah,
yeah. And the enjoying play with her is one thing, and then after dinner, and they put on her bed, and we go back to lab again, and it's like a routine.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, oh yeah, this is how the kids are raised, and then until that part,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, do you bring her into the lab? Or?
Sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, and. She brought another different perspective into my life, because my wife is also a scientist, so I could communicate with her about my research. And even though she become less interested now, and compared with the graduate student or postdocs, but Jess is different because she doesn't know anything about the science,
mm-hmm.
and so she doesn't care anything about it. And it makes you think the science is not everything. So it really brought you outside the world. And I remember one time, the last year, and I went to Philadelphia to receive the Gertrude Elion Award from American Association for Cancer Research, or AACR.
Right.
And that's a big award, that's a national. And so I was the only one from this campus that received it. And I was pretty happy, and the department of cancer is also very happy. I got to start the ceremony and for me. And everybody was happy. I think that's a big deal.
Okay.
So I brought this plaque home and told my daughter, said, yes, look, I brought back. And she looked at it. And I don't know if she did it on purpose, but it's pretty spontaneous. She said, oh, that kind of small. But she went back into her in her playroom and brought her trophy, and she won during her karate tournament. This whole much taller than my plaque.
My trophy is much bigger than
yours. Yeah, and she was so serious. Oh, that's small.
That's funny.
What can you say? Yeah, it was a very genuine response from her.
Right.
Yeah, then really made me realize and that. This is another life,
right.
Outside the lab.
in a way, bringing up kids is like sort of a long, humbling experience, yeah. very you know, enriching.
Yeah. And you think the science is everything to you, is your career, and they've been stuck and they become so concentrated, so focused. And since over the last 15 years,
right.
And it's almost like everything to you, other than your marriage. But now all of a sudden the kids tell you, wait a minute, this whole bigger world out of that, like my karate tournament, it's bigger than your plaque.
Right. So it's opened up this other perspective then, or just broadened the perspective, I guess, in which you see your life.
Yeah, I don't know it. It's just, you actually feel, you have to feel it.
Yeah.
You have to see it, you have to feel it.
Yeah. Now, does she have any idea about what you do? Does she ask questions about,
She does. Yeah, and she know, and we're scientists, we're doing research, and in the long run we'll try to cure the cancer,
right.
And on a quite a superficial way though. Yeah, and I don't know how much she really respect what I'm doing, because it's generated a lot of conflict on her. That on one hand she knows, but what we're doing is a noble cause, it's good, because
right.
you treat a patient, and then and might contribute to the cancer patient the treatment. And so in that part, she knows it's good
mm-hmm.
profession, and there is very good ones. On the other hand, I take too much time out of her. She doesn't like that. And especially when I have to come back to the lab, to the office in the evening. And so that's her playtime, and she doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she's struggling between that. And I think, I hope when she grows up and that she can have more, how do I say this, and they can put her view into more perspective ways. And then nowadays, that's a professional life.
Right.
Yeah, it's demanding. It's not like 8 hours life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be a professional one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just an 8-to-8 job anymore.
Or do you plan on having any more children?
My wife and I was never on the same schedule on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
The time she wanted, I was not very enthusiastic. You know, so busy. And by the time I think and I'm more calm down and established, she said she's out of mood.
Right. not any more interested in that.
Right. And she said, and Jess is already 10 years old, and already past the stage of raising young kids.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to go back again. Yeah.
All right. Tiananmen Square, when it occurred, you remain in the United States. Do you miss China? Do you plan on going back?
Not permanently. I'm right. already citizen of the United States now.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're here.
Yeah. And but I am continue to increase my trip to China.
Mm-hmm.
And my first trip back to China was after 5 years in the United States, and almost 5 years.
Hmm.
Okay, and the second one was 3 years later, and lately I've been going back every year.
Mm-hmm.
I have a mixed view on that part myself. Yes, and on the one hand, I know that it's my inherited and heritage, and I do have a responsibility. I am very interested, and I really wanted to help my colleague and to collaborate with my colleague back in China.
Right.
On the other hand, it's a very different situation that what I'm doing is very basic research, and it costs so much money. I don't think that's what China needs right now
mm-hmm.
at a so early age. Not every country can afford the basic research like the United States. And that China is still in the early economic development, and they emphasize basic research, but and it has to be in a realistic perspective. Whether that was the best for the China right now. So if I doing too much on that part, and I don't know what kind of impact that could have. And not to mention that I'm still at the early stage of my own career development. And right. Before I really establish myself, I've been traveling too much to China. I don't know if it's good or not. Mm-hmm. And what I believe is, and by the time and a few years down the road, when I get more established, and I could have the more impact, and I probably could help them more efficiently.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how about your wife also? She's a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And, I mean, does she miss China?
Not much at all. Not much less than I do.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, one of the bad side effects probably is that you are separated from your parents.
Right.
But you had told me the other day that they come over, they've come over, what, 3 or 4 times
right.
since.
And so that's even more so in the sense of the tradition of a Chinese culture. And there was this old saying of Chinese is, if your parents are still around, you don't go out.
Right.
Yeah, for 1,000 years. And then that's been the case. But obviously, that's just become unrealistic nowadays. And if you go to college, you can stay home. And if you got your job, and you can just come back home and where your parents live. But still, a lot of people do that. And I myself don't feel that anymore. I think that really limits the development of the child. And so my parents, fortunately for me, and both are very well educated on that sense, even though my mother was never get a chance to even go to high school.
Right.
But and very early on, when she was young, just getting married, and she was able to get a job herself. So she appreciated and realized how important to be independent, to get education, mm-hmm. and that kind of philosophy, and is the one that she's been teaching us, and all three of us.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty amazing result, hasn't it?
It is. And that's the one thing they feel the proud of this, and they actually set an example for the people around them. They
right.
say, that, look, the 3 kids and the raised by them, they all become independent, professional, doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I do miss them, and especially with my mom. And I had a very close relationship with my mother. And not just because she raised me all the way, but also in terms of characters, and I envy her a lot. I like her a lot. I really appreciate the way. And she has a big heart,
right.
even though she had much less education compared with other people, especially my father. But she has big heart, so tolerable, and she really forgiven, and she really teach you that, and you ask yourself, but don't ask other people.
Right.
Yeah, and so all those kind of characters, and I really appreciate them. It helps me a lot. And I just wish and I inherited more of her character with my father's part.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father's character was distorted and because of this years of political movement to make her make him into a more self-content and so sometimes self-pity and on the other hand, a critical person.
Right.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, because of her own detour of career development, he actually never got his career developed at all. And then he actually transferred all this hope on me and had a very high expectation
right.
on 3 of us, and particularly on me. And it has good impact early on. But later, I don't think I like that too much.
Right.
And it's kind of a pressure on you. And it also that and now I have a different perspective from him, that and the family is important.
Right.
And without the family, you don't have a base.
Right.
And I don't think he would agree with that part too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, let's turn it over.